Over 70% of Americans now say the war in Iraq wasn't worth it. That's similar to sentiments from the Vietnam era about that conflict. This hour, we compare and contrast the two wars. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, a conversation with Iowa combat veterans of both wars. Michael Mortensen, who served two tours in Iraq in the U.S. Army, and Tony Powers, who served in the U.S. Army Infantry in Vietnam in 1968 and 69, who was also wounded in combat. Also, political analyst Dennis Goldford of Drake University is with us. He'll trace and compare public opinion and politics during both conflicts. Iraq and Vietnam, side by side this hour, after the news. I'm Ben Kiefer with River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Today, you're listening to an encore edition of the program. We are certainly a divided nation. However, we do agree on something overwhelmingly. The war in Iraq was simply not worth fighting. 71% of Americans now say that the war in Iraq wasn't worth it. This according to a relatively new NBC News, Wall Street Journal, Annenberg poll, that from June. Skepticism about this lengthy war effort in Iraq has gone up substantially, even in the past 18 months. And just 22% now believe the war effort in Iraq was launched in 2003 under President Bush was worthwhile. And this criticism of the Iraq War runs across all ages. Just 23% of young adults, 21% of seniors think the war was worthwhile. Support also low among men, only 22% answering that the war was worth it in that group. Now, these poll numbers reflect similar sentiments from the Vietnam era, some 40 years ago, about that unpopular conflict. Now, we know the wars are compared often in conversation, also in the media, but how much are they really alike? And what was it like to serve in wars that are now seen in such a dim light of public opinion by most Americans? This hour, we want to tackle these and many other questions with our guests. Dennis Goldford is with us, professor of political science at Drake University in our Des Moines studio. Hello, Dennis.
Hi, Ben.
Also with us, we are honored to have two Iowa veterans of these two wars with us. Joining us in our Des Moines studio as well, Tony Powers, a Vietnam veteran. He was drafted into the Army, fought in the Vietnam War in the infantry in 1968 and 69, was also wounded in combat. Tony Powers, thank you so much for being with us.
Glad to be here today.
Michael Mortensen is with us, joining us by phone, a veteran of Operation Iraqi Freedom. He served two tours of Iraq in the U.S. Army. Michael Mortensen, welcome to our program.
Thank you, Ben.
Let me start off by reaching out to our veterans and making sure that you have our heartfelt thanks for your service to your country and for the sacrifices you've made, Michael and Tony.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dennis, I'd like to have you start off this hour as we get a footing here in the concept that we have going here. Let's start with the start of each war. Give us a few words of comparison on how each war started and why it started.
Well, you know, there was some initial sending of American troops, military advisors, I should say, during the Kennedy administration to what was going on in Vietnam. The French had been kicked out after 1954 by the Ho Chi Minh, and North Vietnam became what was called then a communist country. American policymakers were really haunted by Munich. The sense of the fact that with the Munich Agreement that acknowledged the Germans' takeover of Czechoslovakia in the 1930s, they thought that, well, if only people had stood up to Hitler, then World War II could have been prevented. So there was this tremendous fear that they did not want to repeat the Munich experience. With regard not, of course, to the Germans at that point, but to what was considered to be international communism. People, whether China, and of course China under Mao Zedong had become communist in 1949. We had the Hungarian Revolution that was aborted in 1956. The Soviets sent troops. But there was a sense that the Soviets and international communism were the American enemy. And there was a belief, again, not accepted by everybody, but there was a belief that communism was on the march and that communism was pretty monolithic. So the fact that you were Vietnamese or Chinese or Russian or Polish was secondary to the fact that you were a communist. So there was a sense that there was this communist menace spreading throughout the world, and they had to be stopped. Mm-hmm. There was real belief at the time, and you sort of wonder what these people think now that we trade with Vietnam, that if you didn't stop the communists in Vietnam, they'd be in San Diego.
In this so-called domino theory.
Right, right. If one country fell, then another country would fall. So at the same time, you had Barry Goldwater during the 1964 years, after, of course, the Kennedy assassination in November of 1963, Goldwater talk about nuking North Vietnam, things like that. And Lyndon Johnson claimed to be the peacemaker. And yet, of course, you had some Goldwater supporters say after the 64 election, well, people told me if I voted for Goldwater, we'd have war in Vietnam. Well, I voted for Goldwater, and sure enough, we have war in Vietnam. Of course, it was Lyndon Johnson's war, at least people claimed. So Johnson initially had said he wouldn't send troops, and yet as of 1965, there was a tremendous buildup. And from 65, 68, 69, in that period, you had 500,000 American troops, like Tony here.
Mm-hmm. Contrast that with our start in the Iraq War in 2003.
Well, as opposed to this generalized fear of the Soviet Union and the dominoes falling in international communism that provided the context, the general atmospherics, if you will, of getting into Vietnam, there was actually an attack on the United States, of course, during 9/11. There were some other incidents earlier, but of course, everybody knows about 9/11. And there was a linkage made by the Bush administration, and to this day, just recently in the Weekly Standard, a neoconservative publication a week or two ago, Dick Cheney and his daughter Mary kept saying basically they were not wrong. They were right to link Iraq and 9/11. But that linkage was made. Now, in fact, neoconservatives in the Bush administration and really reaching back into the 1990s, they were calling for some action against Saddam Hussein and Iraq even before 9/11. But with 9/11 and the Bush administration making the linkage to Saddam Hussein, there was, of course, the desire to hit back and hit back hard for what these people had done to us. And people pretty much went along overwhelmingly with the Bush administration at the time, not just what they did in Afghanistan, but with the invasion of Iraq.
The Bush administration, but we have to say also the Congress, Democrats and Republicans.
Absolutely. Everybody was in favor of it. You know, there is still to some extent a rally around the flag response on the part of the American people when the U.S. is attacked in some way. I mean, as much as a lot of people, certainly on the Republican side and independents, don't think much of the Carter presidency, when hostages were taken in November, I think it was, of 1978, their Carter administration's polling approval ratings were down in subterranean, basically, at that point. But there was a rally around the flag reaction to that. And certainly once 9/11 occurred, and especially when Bush was on the rubble at 9/11 and had the loudspeaker, they may not hear us now, but they're going to hear from us soon. You know, it was great presidential theatrics, and there was a tremendous rally around the flag, and in this case, the president's policy effect at that time.
Okay, Dennis Goldford, we'll get back to you with some more of those aspects in just a moment, but I want to turn to our veterans today. Michael Mortensen, who served in Iraq two tours with the U.S. Army. Tony Powers fought in Vietnam in the infantry, 1968 and 69. I wonder if we can start out with you, Tony, since yours is the first war, giving us a better sense of why you went into, well, you were drafted. I'll save that question for Michael. But Tony, you went into the war, fought in Vietnam. Tell us a little bit about your tasks, your experiences during the tour.
Well, I was telling Dr. Goldford here that it was, you know, Vietnam just seems like a dream. Like I went to sleep and dreamed about it, then woke up and, gosh, it's over. And, you know, I was a 19-year-old in Vietnam with kind of a Clint Eastwood-type chip on my shoulder. You know, I wanted to fight for my country, and Vietnam was a place where if the Viet Cong or North Vietnamese didn't kill you, then the environment would. There, a lot of our veterans, you know, ended up with tropical diseases, and were killed by snake bites and died from snake bites. And there was even one report of we didn't know if it was true or not when we were over in Vietnam at the time, that a Marine up in one of the units up north was actually attacked and killed by a giant tiger and dragged away into the jungle. And that was just such a terrifying story. Now, I don't know if that were true or not, but that was the story that we heard.
And Tony, you yourself were wounded fairly seriously.
Well, I, you know, suffered some wounds, and I'm lucky to have survived. A lot of my friends didn't, and I'm just really fortunate to have still have some of my health, majority of my health today. And I know there's a lot of the Vietnam veterans out there today that are, you know, suffering from all kinds of illnesses that they suffered over in Vietnam. And just very fortunate today to have survived, and thank God every day for it.
Mm-hmm. Tony Powers, Vietnam veteran, with us along with the Iraq War veteran Michael Mortensen. I want to reach out to our listeners and invite their input this hour. Did you serve our country in either war? What are your reflections as we put these conflicts side by side to compare and contrast them? 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Let me, before I go to you, Michael, Tony, tell us, what's your reaction to the polls showing now the Iraq War, at least in this sense, on par in terms of asking people whether it's worthwhile? To the extent that this was, it's now similar to the Vietnam War. What are your thoughts?
As far as the whether people agree or not with the war, I remember in Vietnam, they say that we lost the war in Vietnam, and that bothers me, because every battle that my unit was in, Bravo Company and the 9th Division, the Mekong Delta, we won substantially, and we just lost the will to fight. And there's a big difference, losing the war versus losing the will to fight. I was one of those veterans that I disagreed that we should have gone into Iraq. I disagreed with the war there. As far as Vietnam, again, I was drafted, pretty much had no choice when I went there. But the Iraq War, I think if Saddam Hussein were alive today, that we could control him in Iraq. Mm-hmm. And of course, that war, almost bankrupted our country. So again, that was why I was against the war in the first place.
Michael Mortensen, tell us, why did you get into the war? No draft in the Iraqi war. Why did you sign up?
No draft for me. That passed me up. But I joined the military. First of all, my whole family has served in the military, and it was just kind of in my blood to do. But I think there was a big push of patriotism and an urge to serve your country after 9/11. I think that was very widespread, and it really just drove me further to join and to serve my country.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about your two tours. What stands out? What images can you give us about your experience?
We had two different experiences on my two deployments there. My first one, I served on a reconnaissance and convoy security team, hundreds of missions out on the road. Saw a lot of the villages, the communities, the cities, met with a lot of people, and also saw quite a bit more action during the first tour. But it enabled me to spend a lot more time with the Iraqi population. The second deployment, I had switched into military police and was actually in charge of one of the prison camps in southern Iraq. So I got to deal with a lot of the prisoners there. So I got to see both sides of things. I got a big perspective on everything that was going on in Iraq.
Mm-hmm. What's it like now to hear the results of these polls dipping significantly just in the last couple of years? Now you served in a war that is viewed as unpopular.
Absolutely, and I saw the change myself. The first tour that I did was fairly early on in the war, and again, that patriotism and that urgency to serve was very dominant, even with the people that I served with. As we moved along, though, we were seeing progress. We saw things changing in the population, how things were going, and then it seemed as if we were pulling out already at a time that success was already starting to come in. So it was a big disappointment on the soldiers and the other service members that I was with, as far as all this hard work and time and effort put into it, and it seemed as if we were leaving with lives lost and time lost without an end result.
Dennis Goldford, talk about the turning points of these two wars, when perhaps actions on the ground, events on the ground, changed public opinion.
Well, with regard to Vietnam, people say that Vietnam was the first television war. I mean, we had pictures in our living rooms and our family rooms on television. And television then, of course, was not cable, not internet. It was simply the big three networks, ABC, NBC, and CBS. But we had correspondence during World War II, writing stories, and maybe doing some filming, but we didn't have television accounts of that, certainly not contemporaneous television accounts of World War II. We had that in Vietnam. We saw what was happening to soldiers. We saw what was happening to civilians. Some people argued at the time that we never could have successfully fought World War II if we had had the kind of coverage that we had during Vietnam, because people could actually see what was going on, not just those who had loved ones not come home or would come home pretty beaten up and with their wounds. But we kept being promised that we would win the war, but there was disagreement as to what winning the war meant exactly. Again, one view was the war was an act of aggression from North Vietnam. Another view was, as one protest song went, we're sending 50,000 more to help save Vietnam from Vietnamese. You know, that was part of the anti-war argument, that we're interfering in what's essentially a civil war that doesn't really affect us. But people used to say that Walter Cronkite sort of oversaw a piece on what was going on the ground and finally himself expressed some skepticism as to whether the U.S. could accomplish its goals in Vietnam. Supposedly, the Johnson White House said among themselves, we've now lost public support for the war. So that was significant for Vietnam.
And the Tet Offensive in 1968 is often brought up.
Sure. There was a failed offensive on the part of the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong. But again, there's a difference between winning or losing a battle and winning and losing a war. You can win a battle and still lose a war in terms of popular support, in terms of the belief that you really do have accomplishable goals. And increasingly, the country began to believe that the goals really were not accomplishable. I would note real quickly, though, that there's a lot of mythology to the opposition to the war. The anti-war movement really was not that large. Now, it got a lot of press. It got coverage on college campuses and so forth, the various protests, whether on campuses or in cities. But really, the vast bulk of the American population had the view, either win it or get out. And I think when the population as a whole reached the view that we either wouldn't or couldn't win it, their view was get out. The anti-war movement got the coverage, but I think that was less significant than the general view on the population that we either wouldn't or couldn't get it and therefore should get win it and therefore should get out.
Tony Powers, when we talk about the protests, things going on back here on the home front when you're in Vietnam in 68 and 69, how much did what was going on back here matter to you, those protests? Did that reach you? Does popular support for a war matter to a soldier that far away in combat in that situation?
Not really. When you're just trying to survive, we really didn't think a lot about that. Of course, we heard the stories and read the about it in the newspapers and in the Army Times and that sort of thing. But our thought process was you just basically had to survive and with the hopes of serving your year there and getting out and coming back home. And I remember when I did come back from Vietnam, I was telling Dr. Goldford that my mother and I were in church after I got back, and we were just coming out of church, and a woman came running up to me and said, you were there. You were one of them that was there in Vietnam. You killed civilians. You killed people. And I felt, what do you say when someone, I said, I was there, but I didn't kill civilians, and just kind of walked away. So that was the attitude that you had to face when you came back from Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. Let's turn to you, Michael Mortensen, Iraqi war veteran. While we're on this topic of what's going on in the home front, of course, we're now 40-some years later in the Iraq War,
fully into the digital age, that media was consumed by you about pretty much at the same time we were consuming it here, right?
Absolutely. With the technology changes and things like that, there was constant news. There was times that, I mean, we'd have CNN constantly going. At times when we were placed with TVs, it wasn't having any issue to get satellite reception and see the news that everybody was watching at home while they were having their dinner. We were sitting there and in that environment watching the same thing. So,
mm-hmm. And you point to the turning point in Iraq as did I hear you mention the surge and the end of the surge?
Absolutely. As far as the change in the mentality of the soldiers was there, like I said, the patriotism, the willing to serve, the I guess to get back, if you will, from 9/11, that was what was driving everyone. And then to see the soldiers being pulled out when we know the job isn't finished, but yet there was times and lives wasted while we were leaving.
Mm-hmm. Dennis Goldford, where do you put the turning point of the Iraq War?
Well, it depends upon whether you're talking about the success or lack of success of what we were doing or public support for the war. So which would you say?
Let's go with public support. Since we were talking about the media, what made the biggest impact here?
Well, right before the surge, as Michael was saying, that was certainly helped solidify some support for it. But things were pretty grim before the surge. It seemed as though we were stuck in another quagmire. And popular support tended to turn away from the war at that point. The surge helped a bit, but still, you had increasing numbers of people skeptical that we could accomplish what we wanted, because it was a question of setting up a government that itself would be capable of dealing with terrorism and dealing with its own security concerns. And, on the one hand, if you view that there's nothing that U.S. military power can't accomplish, then the failure to set up a government like that is a result of our application, our failure to use our military properly. If you argue that there's some things that even U.S. military cannot accomplish, then you can say that we tried, but ultimately it's a matter for the Iraqis to take care of their own security and their own concerns and hold together their own country. If they can't do it, we can't stay there forever. And that was the view of a lot of people who began, certainly from the period before the surge on, began to lose the faith that really we had a manageable, accomplishable task.
Dennis Goldford is with us, professor of political science at Drake University. Michael Mortensen, Operation Iraqi Freedom Veteran, Iraq Veteran War, War Veteran. Tony Powers, a Vietnam veteran. We want to continue our conversation after a short break. Michael, you mentioned to our producer before you listened to some music out in Iraq. We wanted to play a little bit of Rooster by Alice in Chains. What did this mean to you then out in Iraq?
I think it brings up a lot of the similarities between the two wars. The song was written actually about about his father, who was in Vietnam, being a machine gunner. And it's kind of the same similarities where you didn't know where your enemy was. And
okay.
That just kind of gave that same feeling of going out there and not knowing what was to be expected.
We'll be right back with more of our conversation as we put Vietnam and Iraq, the wars, side by side. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Send me pictures of my boy. Got my
I'm Ben Kiefer with River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Today you're listening to an encore edition of the program.
Today on the program, as recent polls showing a large majority of Americans don't think the Iraq War was worth it, reflecting similar public sentiments from the Vietnam War about that conflict, we compare the two and ask, how much are they really alike? Dennis Goldford is along to Give us some context about the two wars and offer some comparisons and contrasts. Professor of Political Science at Drake University. We're honored to have two Iowa veterans of the two wars with us, Michael Mortensen, veteran of the Iraq War, and Tony Powers, a Vietnam veteran. We'd like to have you join our conversation. What do you see when you compare the Iraq and Vietnam War? 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Iowa Public Radio is also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. I wanted to turn initially to our veterans and ask Tony and Michael. Let me start with you, Michael. Do you get together with veterans of Vietnam? And if so, what do you talk about?
Absolutely. I deal with a lot of veterans. I enjoy talking to all veterans. And the conversation always does come up about the similarities between Vietnam. And what's funny is how much difference the veterans of both wars seem to think that there are. It seems the Vietnam veterans, a lot of the ones that I speak to, assume that we had it a lot tougher, and it was a lot tougher war that we were fighting. In return, Iraq veterans seem to think that the Vietnam veterans had it a lot tougher, and commend both.
Mm-hmm. So you, are you of the opinion that the Vietnam veteran had it tougher than you did?
I would definitely say that. But, and again, that's just my opinion. If I had served in Vietnam, I may have a different opinion on it.
Why?
Mostly, I think there's been so many advancements in technology. The way we fight wars, our weapon systems are a lot more efficient. I think also on another side of things, I think soldiers and service members are taken care of a lot better now than what they were compared to being just drafted and go and fight. There's a lot more evaluation before you're able to join the military. I think you just have a different fighting force now.
Mm-hmm. And you're being better taken care of. I think that is partially responsible for some of the casualties here. One of the big contrasts here, more than 58,000 Americans dying in Vietnam compared to fewer than 5,000 in Iraq. Tony Powers, what do you like to talk with Iraq veterans about? Do you believe, for instance, that they had it tougher than you did?
Well, you know, as far as I remember in Vietnam, we used to strip down to basically to just wear the basics out in the field because it was just so hot. And you had 50, 60 pounds of equipment that you were carrying, plus your weapon. And in contrast to Iraq, you know, the Iraqi soldiers, you know, they wore a lot of body armor and that sort of stuff that we really didn't wear in Vietnam just simply because it was too hot. And of course, to get through the rice paddies and through the jungle, cut your way through the jungle, the canopy was so thick you couldn't see the sky. And I was telling Dr. Goldford about how hot it was over there, the temperatures, 120. And of course, I know it was hot in Iraq too, but I think, you know, the Vietnam soldiers, we tried to get by with as less as we could out in the field. Just to keep going, in contrast to Iraq, where they wore all the body armor and equipment.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to our callers, 1-866-780-9100 this hour, putting the Iraq and Vietnam wars side by side to see what we come up with as far as similarities and also contrasts. Mary is with us in Iowa City. Hi, Mary.
Hi. You know, I see those wars, they were the same. But I want to ask your professor about Iran in 1953.
Well, our topics are Iraq and Vietnam. I'm afraid that's
all that leads down.
Okay.
You said communism, right? We're fighting communism. And the Dallas brothers, see, this is what gets us in trouble, is war propaganda. And the PNAC letter in 1997 helped lead us into 9/11. And for the soldier who said that we were running in Vietnam, that's the same thing Hitler said about World War I. Why did they stop the war? We were winning.
Okay, Mary, let's talk a little bit about that, Dennis Goldford. Are there parallels, contrasts in the way Presidents Johnson and Bush sold these wars? We have that big title, which I've said a couple of times, Operation Iraqi Freedom. It's not Operation Get Rid of Saddam's WMD, is it?
Well, Americans tend to be a people who want to deal with the world in somewhat idealistic terms. In other words, Americans aren't really comfortable with power politics, issues of sort of sometimes called crass national interest. You know, I think the French, or there was a French diplomat who famously said, we have no permanent friends, we have only permanent interests. That's sort of a realist approach, as it's called, in international relations in that particular field. But the idealists are the ones who say that we want to fight if we have to fight, and we engage the world in terms of our values. And American wars have usually been fought and sold to the American public in terms of values. So if we talked about fighting for oil or trying to prevent certain kinds of despicable regimes from being expansionist and so forth, it's easier for Americans to talk in terms of freedom. I mean, President Bush with Iraq sounded at times as though he were going to create a Jeffersonian democracy on the banks of the Tigris and Euphrates. And some people argue that's not something that's possible because you can't plant something in a country with no tradition or history or culture of having a certain kind of liberal democracy focusing on freedom the way other countries do. The other view is you can impose any kind of political system you want anywhere in the world if you have enough will and enough power. So there's that conflict over that issue.
Mike is joining us from Ankeny. Hi, Mike. Welcome to our program.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Did you serve in one of these wars?
Actually, I served in Iraq in 05 to 07. I got caught up in the surge there, so we stayed a little longer.
Thank you for your service, Mike.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. It's been my pleasure, really. And then I just got back from Afghanistan in 2011. So, mm-hmm.
Do you have a question or an observation?
I just wanted to make an observation, let people know. You know, the one frustrating thing is for me as a veteran is, you know, I feel like there's an uninformed opinion out there by most Americans about, you know, why we went to war and why we were there and if it was right. And I think the problem is once politicians make the decision that we need to go to war, they continue to allow public opinion to drive that war, and it needs to, that needs to stop. And I think that's one of the things that happened in Vietnam is that politicians were so concerned with the public opinion that it drove the war and the policies. I think that if politicians could just set goals for the military and say, this is what we want, this is what our end state needs to be, go, and just let us do it, it'll get done.
Okay, Mike, let's let Dennis Goldfer react to that, because public opinion is for better or worse, a huge part of launching and maintaining a war, isn't it, Dennis?
That's right. I mean, I understand what the caller's saying. The difficulty is, in a democracy, there's support for the government and its policies, as long as those policies are considered to be legitimate and as long as those policies are considered at some level to respect the will of the people. In a democracy, you've got a problem if the will of the people, which can be fickle, but if it changes and no longer supports the policy pursued by the government. I mean, right now, people will say that critics will say that President Obama is relatively weak and is withdrawing from the world in ways he shouldn't be. Whether or not that's a wise course of action, he's tracking pretty much where the public is right now. But let me draw a distinction that the caller raises that I think is important, and I'll be brief, that we've got to distinguish two things that really have to be too often melded together, but they got to be kept separate. The job of the military is to carry out the directives of the civilian government, our political officials, with success and certainly with courage and dedication. And that's a separate issue entirely from whether the mission itself is the right thing or a wise thing or the wrong thing to do. The problem that happened with our Vietnam vets was so much of the country began to think that the mission itself was wrong. What they did then was disparage and turn against the people who, in good faith, the military, tried to carry out that mission with courage and dedication. Mm-hmm. And we felt guilty about that as a country for a long time, which is why we've been so much better with Iraq vets and Afghanistan vets.
Tony, let me jump in at this point, a perfect point to ask Tony about his welcome home to the United States. You returned home in what year? Vietnam.
I returned home, but in 1969.
Mm-hmm. And how was the welcome there? When you certainly have watched the Iraq veterans, Afghanistan veterans return home. What was the difference for you?
Well, the big difference is, you know, Iraqi veterans they were celebrated when they came back, and Vietnam veterans weren't. We were pretty much considered outcast, and that was just the mood of the country. And we were called baby killers and civilian killers, and and that sort of thing. And I remember the Iraq War. Remember in 1990, they had this huge parade right here in Des Moines, downtown Des Moines, for the veterans. I don't know if you remember that, Dr. Gold, for the big veteran parade. We didn't have any parades when we came back from Vietnam.
How did you deal with that then, being shunned, being told to just go away because we don't like the war we sent you to fight?
Well, you basically had to get on with your life, and my big thing was that I was so happy that I survived Vietnam, that I was just able to come home and still be able to walk around. I was, and I thank God to this day for that.
Mm-hmm. Michael Mortensen, your reflections on how the Iraq veteran was welcome compared to the Vietnam veteran, a huge difference here. Veterans who served in Iraq, largely honored and respected, celebrated as they return.
Absolutely, absolutely. Everyone was very happy to see you. I remember, flying back home to the airports, and people would line up and clap as we walked through, and hugs and thank yous. There was only a few minor instances of individuals who weren't really appreciative, but almost everyone was just so happy and grateful and would be glad to tell you that.
Mm-hmm. Did you see that distinction that we had here that Dennis brought up between perhaps disagreeing with the war, people celebrating you, respecting you, honoring you, even though they may not have agreed with the war?
I would say after my first tour, I didn't hear anything about it. It was just nothing but thank you. And after my second tour came back, you heard more and more, I don't agree with what's going on over there, but thank you for your service. Mm. Thank you for what you've done. So
that little preface.
To be a very common thing to be said.
That's precisely the difference. I mean, the worth of the mission is a separate issue from the bravery and dedication of the troops. The troops can perform with tremendous bravery and dedication for a mission that really is not the smartest thing in the world. And unfortunately, too often, we've sort of merged the two ideas. So dislike of the mission, certainly in Tony's generation, translated into dislike of the troops.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about the aftermath of these wars. We're early on in the aftermath of the Iraq War. Of course, Vietnam is in our history. But Vietnam has remained a difficult subject for years. It's been present in our popular culture, in movies. After the fighting stopped, we are still churning through the legacy of Vietnam. But if we look at the news about Iraq, and Dennis, you take the first, doesn't it seem like it's pretty much disappeared from a lot of political discourse?
Well, of course, things are blowing up all over the world, which raises questions of what American foreign policy should be. But Americans, at least outside the South, forget hell, that particular phrase they use all the time with regard to the Civil War, or as Southerners call it, the War of Northern Aggression. Americans tend to have a fairly short memory, and we get on to the things involving our friends and our families, especially in our careers and our jobs and so forth. Obama was elected on the promise of winding down the Iraq War. Remember, he called that a war of choice, whereas he considered Afghanistan a war of necessity. It's up to individual people to judge his success or failure at pursuing that particular war of necessity. Mm-hmm. But he was elected on the part of a popular groundswell to be, despite the heroism and the dedication of the troops, it was time to get past Iraq. It was time for the Iraqis to stand or fall on their own. We couldn't prop them up forever. And Americans, particularly with the recession that started in 2008, were ready to move on to domestic concerns.
Mm-hmm. An email from Jeff for listening. He writes, one difference was that after Vietnam, the architects of the Vietnam fiasco, writes Jeffrey, like McNamara, were disgraced and did not appear in public or on television. Today, you can find Cheney interviewed all over corporate media as experts. Dennis.
Well, as I mentioned, Cheney and his daughter have a piece in Weekly Standard from a week or so ago saying we were right and we should have pursued that and so forth. But, we've had for generations in the 50s or so, it was who lost China, then it was who lost Vietnam. This constantly comes back because it speaks to the question of what's the proper U.S. role in world affairs. I think a big thing that happened with Vietnam that's had an impact on our response to Iraq was, to a great extent, Americans before Vietnam fairly much trusted the government, and they fairly much trusted what governmental officials said. And one of the corrosive results of the Vietnam experience was the lack of trust or decreasing trust in American governmental institutions, and particularly a lack of trust that the government would in fact tell you the truth.
Mm-hmm. Let me go to Michael Mortensen on that very point, serving in Iraq. Did you at that time trust the government, what the government was saying, the goal the government put forward, and did that change over time?
Absolutely, and just like Dennis touched on, our job at that time when you were in that uniform and in that situation isn't really to question what's being said behind you. You're to take the orders and go with them, and you have the trust in your government and in your leaders that they're what they're having you to do is the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm. I want to wind up by asking both Michael and Tony about post-war life for you two. Undoubtedly, the conflicts which you served our country in have shaped you in pretty big ways. But, Tony, what are the biggest challenges you still face that are related to your service over 40 years ago?
Well, I've really had a great life after Vietnam. I had a career in broadcasting, which I enjoyed. But it's still difficult today, from the wounds that I suffered in Vietnam over 40 years ago. But I go day to day, and as I said before, I'm real fortunate to have the majority of good health today, and that's what I'm thankful for.
Mm-hmm. Physical wounds, what about wounds otherwise? Do you carry those as well?
I try to some of the time, yes. I mean, you can't be in combat and not be affected by it for the rest of your life. And, some days you have difficult days, other days you don't, and you get through it as best you can.
Mm-hmm. Michael Mortensen, biggest challenges for you as an Iraq veteran today?
I can't really speak too much on the physical side of it that Tony can. However, on the mental strain, coming back is always a tough thing to do, and I've got a lot of soldiers underneath me that have gotten a lot worse than I have. But it is a constant battle. It's day by day. My family would tell you that I suffer every single day. But it's just one of the things you just take day at a time and learn to cope with things and the things that you've seen and the things that you've done.
Mm-hmm. Dennis, words before we go, we have a couple minutes left, but I'm wondering, when it comes to U.S. intervention in Iraq to stop militants from taking over the country, the latest in the developments in Iraq, Americans are divided in the polls. They say the U.S. Half say the U.S. does not have a responsibility to intervene, and 43% say the U.S. has an obligation to help. Might Vietnam have any lessons for Iraq at this point forward?
Well, people will argue over whether, in fact, we could have, quote unquote, won the Vietnam War, but people dispute what that means. As I said, it's ironic. I mean, even John McCain, who was held captive for, 4 or 5 years in Vietnam, visited Vietnam and toured and everything, and we have trade delegations there and so forth. The communists didn't show up in San Diego, as was predicted. But I think that there are arguments, as I said, about the proper U.S. role in world affairs. I mean, John Adams, our second president, once said, if I remember it correctly, we are supporters of liberty throughout the world. We are defenders only of our own. Mm-hmm. It's the idea that countries have to make their own decisions. We can try to support them, but at some point they've got to stand on their own. We can't do everything. The other view, as I said, it's more of a neoconservative view, is that there's almost no problem in the world that can't be improved, if not solved, by the application of U.S. military power if we do it long enough with enough dedication and insight. So there's this fundamental argument about what the U.S. role is in world affairs. The thing I think we have to watch out for is that we can't, while we support and treasure the dedication and courage of our troops, we can't let political figures justify any particular kind of military adventure or foreign policy solely by saying our troops perform with great courage and dedication. We've got to understand the wisdom or lack thereof particular policies. So the best way to support the troops is to make sure that we don't abuse the troops. That is, we don't put them in circumstances where they can't succeed or whether the cost is or the price is too high.
Okay, Dennis Goldford, professor of politics, political science at Drake University. It's been a pleasure having you on with your reflections as we put the Iraq and Vietnam wars side by side. Thank you, Dennis.
Very interesting program, Ben.
And a great pleasure to have our two veterans on with us, Michael Mortensen, veteran of Operation Iraqi Freedom, and Tony Powers, a Vietnam veteran, served in 1968 and 69, was also wounded. Gentlemen, again, thank you for your service, for taking part in this program. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Ben. Appreciate
Thanks for having us. Thank you.
There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there, telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
And that's it for today. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. If you want to hear a podcast of this program or any of our other prior talk shows, go to iowapublicradio.org. You'll find podcasting and on-demand audio of River to River and Talk of Iowa. Our theme music is written and performed by the River Monks. We always welcome your comments and questions about this program. You can contact us anytime. Here's our email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.
What a field day for the heat.